Good evening, and welcome to our final program in the series, Lincoln, the Constitution, and the Civil War. And what a series it has been. Abraham Lincoln was forced to make many decisions, many without precedent, and many have not been repeated as well. But the legacy of the constitutional decisions, the leadership, the communication style has come down to our own present day and has affected how our government makes decisions today. It has affected how politicians act today. This exhibition, Lincoln, the Constitution, and the Civil War, was sponsored by the American Library Association and the National Constitution Center, and made possible by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. And here in our campus was sponsored by WKU Libraries, Department of Library Special Collections, Kentucky Library and Museum. Unfortunately, this evening, Glenn LaFantasy was unable to join the panel because of an emergency, but we have the other speakers who were in this series. Starting on the left side, we have Nancy Baird. Nancy Baird retired in 2010 after spending 35 years as the Kentucky History Specialist in the Department of Library Special Collections, including 3 years as interim department head. She's been a frequent speaker at professional events and has written or co-authored 9 books related to the history of Bowling Green, history of Kentucky, and medical history. In 2009, she published Josie Underwood's Civil War Diary, an account of the Civil War by a young Bowling Green woman who was pro-slavery but sympathized with the Union. The diary won the 2009 Basil Duke Award for the best publication relating to the Confederacy. Carol Crow-Carrico is a distinguished professor in the history department, specializing in Kentucky history, history of women, and Tudor Stuart England. She has written numerous books and articles and has frequently collaborated with Nancy Baird. As a matter of fact, one of tonight's door prizes is actually, they are two of the 3 authors of. Carol is presently working on a biography of Henry M. Eames, an early Kentucky jurist, a study of Adam Leopold and Sarah Gilbert Alexander, a Georgia antebellum couple, overviews of various Kentucky homes, and a literacy book for adults learning to read. Dr. Cecile Garman is director of the Leadership Studies Program and professor of communications. She has many years of experience and is a frequent speaker at professional events in both the fields of leadership studies and communications. She earned her PhD at Vanderbilt in Educational Philosophy, Intercultural Education Policy, and received a certificate from the Harvard University Institute of Educational Management. Dr. Patricia Minter is Associate Professor of History and works in the field of legal and constitutional history. She received her PhD from the University of Virginia and is the author of several articles, the most recent published in Law and History Review. She is co-editor of Signposts, New Directions in Southern Legal History, which is forthcoming from the University of Georgia Press and should be out next year in 2012. She is also finishing a book on segregation law in the South. And so at this point, I would like to turn the program over to the panelists.
Thank you, Brian, and thank all of you for coming. Don't worry about the fantasy not being here. The women can do it. I think we'd all agree that it is impossible to narrow the cause of the Civil War down to a single issue or act. It is true that slavery was the overriding factor, but it wasn't the only cause. In truth, I think we should all agree, we may not, that there were a lot of causes and issues that brought the North and the South against each other. But they had begun, you know, before 1861. I when I put this together, I came up with six causes, my causes. Anyone else who starts off would probably have their own causes. And I've kind of put them together in a chronological sequence because I had to get from the invention of the cotton gin to the election of Abraham Lincoln. So, my six causes. Economic and social differences between the North and the South. Secondly, but not in importance, remember, federal versus states' rights. Three, conflict between non-slave and slave proponents. The growth. Number four, the abolition movement. Number five, the acceleration of the strident voices of people as politics became so polarized that compromise could not occur, but violence could. And then the election of Abraham Lincoln. And I forgot the cotton again tonight. I do apologize. I put it out. There was a New Englander who was down in Georgia in 1793, and he invented the cotton gin. And if you all recall, those of you who are here, I pointed out that the cotton gin was an unbelievable device, because prior to its invention, it would probably take you all day to remove the seed from 1 pound of cotton. And then all of a sudden, you could process 50. So, and so you see the difference that cotton is going to make in the economy of the South and the laboring classes. As far as federal rights and states' rights are concerned, I think from its inception, the United States contained the roots of the Civil War. Think about it. The first organized government for the United States after the American Revolution was under a purposely vague Articles of Confederation. And the 13 states liked this loose confederation. Here in Kentucky, we flirted with a little document called the Kentucky Resolutions. I always say that it was kind of a dry run for the issues that faced people in the 1850s, 1860s. And then we've got the conflict between slave and non-slave proponents. We have our own Henry Clay to thank for a couple of compromises. And there are even those people who say that if Clay had been alive, the Civil War might well have been put off again. I don't know if I'll go that far or not. But the legacy of Henry Clay. We've got the growth of the anti-slavery movement. To abolitionists, slavery was a moral question, not an economic one. The institution itself seemed a contradiction to the principles of the American Revolution, that all human beings had been created with natural rights. The abolition cause was aided by the publication in 1852 of Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. Stowe, a Connecticut-born schoolteacher, an ardent abolitionist, created the character of Uncle Tom after supposedly reading the memoirs of Josiah Henson, a runaway slave from Kentucky. Her sentimental novel depicting the reality of slavery sold something like 300,000 copies the first year, becoming the second best-selling book of the century. And although it's doubtful that Abraham Lincoln greeted Stowe with the oft-quoted, "So this is the little lady who started this great war," perhaps he should have, you know. I think also important is the Dred Scott decision of 1857, when Scott loses his 11-year battle, I believe it was, and the court rules that the Missouri Compromise is unconstitutional. That's sobering. If all territories are now open to slavery, how long would it be before a move was made to reintroduce slavery in the free states? The Dred Scott decision certainly furthered the cause of the abolitionists. Then there are those events in Kansas and events at Harper's Ferry. Brown's raid shocked the South because it aroused the great fear of a slave rebellion. Now, I'm not sure how many Southerners in the late 1850s, beginning of the 1860s, wanted to secede from the Union. But the political passions of the election of 1860, the election of Abraham Lincoln, certainly fostered secessionist thoughts.
Well, certainly the election of 1860 was one of the most important, one of the most far-reaching, and one of the most dramatic elections in American history. There were four candidates that year. Just imagine four people running around and all their friends running around and campaigning. The Northern Democrats, who believed that slavery, the issue of slavery, should be decided at the territorial level, ran Stephen A. Douglas of Illinois. Douglas campaigned all across the United States. He even campaigned as far south as New Orleans, supposedly drawing a fine crowd. Somehow or another, I wonder just why the fine crowd went, but that's what the papers said. The Southern Democrats ran John Breckinridge of Kentucky, who was then serving as Vice President of the United States. The Southern Democrats said that the question of slavery should be decided at the state level. Every state ought to decide whether they would be come into the Union as a free state or a slave state. The Constitutional Union Party, which was a relatively new party, decided to run John Bell of Tennessee, and they just simply sidestepped the slavery issue by saying that they upheld the Constitution. And then the fourth party was a new party that in 1856 had first appeared on the ballot. I don't know how many votes the Republicans got across the nation in 1856, but they received a whopping 300 in Kentucky, which only says they didn't receive many. They were not, the Republicans were not very popular here. But in 1860, they, of course, ran Abraham Lincoln of Illinois. Lincoln himself did not campaign. It was not considered quite cricket for the presidential candidate to be running around campaigning, and so he's the only one of the four who did not, although certainly many campaigned for him. I think it's interesting that all four of these candidates come from a little nucleus in the Midwest. Two from Illinois, one from Kentucky, one from Tennessee. I've often wondered what the people of New Hampshire and Maine and Massachusetts thought about that. I mentioned a minute ago that the Republicans in Kentucky in 1856 received 300 and some votes. In 1860, they received 1,300 votes, which is hardly a sprinkling of votes. But once again, I think it does show that even in a state where Lincoln was not popular, the growth of the Republican Party was still rather dramatic. So you have four candidates running for President of the United States. Lincoln received a minority of the popular votes, but he received 40% of the electoral votes, and thus, as a minority president, was elected President of the United States. On his election, there was considerable controversy, and it appears in the paper, oh, woe is me, what is going to happen? The southern states, are they going to secede? If so, only one state might secede, or maybe they'll all secede. Nobody seems to know, but if you read the Kentucky newspapers, you really get this feel of woe is me. Everybody is much concerned about what is going to happen. Was Lincoln afraid of what was going to happen? I'm sure he was. On the other hand, I can't imagine that he truly realized, thought, understood, if anybody did, what was about to happen, that states would secede. Now, when South Carolina secedes, I think a lot of people assume that that South Carolina is just going to be dangling out there by herself. But then six other states join, and that's beginning to look pretty sad. And then, of course, the war actually begins. What else was I supposed to talk about here? I think the election of 1860 certainly is, as I say, the most dramatic, the most far-reaching, and maybe the most frightening election in American history.
It's for historians.
Okay. And I certainly hope that's the case, Nancy.
Oh.
I spoke on Lincoln and habeas corpus, but tonight I actually want to focus my remarks on things that will augment what my colleagues have already talked about. My thinking on how inevitable civil war was has certainly changed over time, as everyone's does, as we learn more. And I suppose I would still come down where I have on other panel discussions before in saying that the moment that the Civil War really becomes inevitable is with the Dred Scott decision, which does many things that I'll come back to. But in the process of working this semester on this edited volume on Southern legal history, which I'm terribly excited about, I had the pleasure to edit a piece on Southern jurist and pro-slavery thought that is really changing the way that I look, or at least making me rethink a lot of the things that I've already thought. And this piece is about people who had law training, who wrote or read in the law, but not all of them practiced law. In fact, many of them were college presidents. And one of the things that I realized in this survey of these Southern jurists is, one, they all self-defined, and these are people who were writing between 1830 and 1860 in states that did secede. They all self-defined as conservative, which is not a phrase that you actually see used a lot in political discourse in the 19th century, although it's certainly an identifiable point of view. And they self-identified as conservative, defined as following that they wanted to maintain the status quo. And the status quo was slavery, and the status quo was the superior position of the white man, and that this is the way that things should and ought to forever be in the South. And these people, whether they were university presidents, sitting judges, legal treatise writers, or people who argued at the bar and then also wrote in various journals, put together a web that, for me, makes civil war just as inevitable as Justice Taney's decision did in Dred Scott. One of the things that makes it inevitable is the growing sense after the 1830s, particularly after the Nat Turner Rebellion, which led to the death of 60 people in Virginia. There is a sense that there has to be a clampdown on slavery, that slave insurrection is an ever-present threat, and therefore anybody in the South who was, let's say, soft on slavery had to be dealt with, and had to be dealt with pretty firmly. The president of Washington College in Lexington, Virginia, which is now, after the Civil War, becomes Washington and Lee College, but the president of Washington College was actually if not an abolitionist, someone who wasn't entirely sure that slavery wasn't a necessary evil, as opposed to the shifting conception that slavery was a positive good, something to be defended, something to be seen as necessary for the order of society. For this heresy, which is writing in scholarly tomes that suggested that maybe he wasn't gung-ho on slavery, he was run out of his post as president. And never again did, until after the war, did a non-promoter of slavery sit in the president's chair. You see that in Southern institutions of higher education, being pro-slavery was the litmus test that leadership had to pass. In the places where one read law, increasingly after 1830, those with whom you read law were all pro-slavery, and increasingly militantly so. By the time we get to the 1850s, after the last of Senator Clay's great compromises, we see that all of the threads of civility on this issue are fraying greatly. We see people like Georgia's Thomas R.R. Cobb, who will be killed in the Civil War. But we see people like him writing in his treatise on slavery that it's practically a cheerleading treatise on behalf of slavery. It's not only a positive good, it's the most necessary positive good that has ever existed in society. And he condemns openly anyone who has ever said anything to the contrary, including one of the jurists that I've written about, Lord Mansfield, who was the Chief Justice of the King's Bench in London, who is denounced in terms that you would think it was a South Carolinian denouncing the election of Lincoln. But he is denounced as being part of Negromania, is the phrase that is used to describe Lord Mansfield, for suggesting that if you don't have a slave code, you can't necessarily have slavery, talking about London in 1772. But this very existence offended Cobb. In a case in 1859 in Mississippi called Mitchell versus Wells, we see a case that really does upend everything that was established law prior to it. In slavery, the master has domain, absolute domain over slaves. And in this case, a master wants to leave his estate to his daughter, who was the product of his liaison with one of his slaves. His daughter was now living free in Ohio. Upon his death, he wanted to pass his property to her. Now, if you believe in the absolute domain of a slave owner, then his word is bond, right? It has to happen. But the only thing more odious than violating absolute domain of the master is having a free black female in Mississippi who owns land. And this just can't happen. So in 1859, Mitchell versus Wells, state level case, completely upends the Southern law of slavery, refusing to grant, Nancy Wells is her name, refusing to grant her inheritance, making it clear that if she sets foot on Mississippi soil, all states' rights will be abolished. She's free in Ohio, but the minute she sets foot on Mississippi soil, she will revert to unfree status. She will be taken and enslaved, so she dare not cross the line past Memphis to claim her property, thus completely obliterating the argument for states' rights, because it's just not possible anymore, because there's no longer a right to take freedom with you. It's absolutely, Mississippi is nationalizing its status of unfree. And in another opinion, here you see this phrase Negromania cropping up again. Mississippi Supreme Court condemns Ohio for having the temerity to allow freedom, and claims that Ohio is a cursed state in a state of negromania. So this has nothing to do with law, with inheritance, or anything that the case should have been about. It is a giant editorial screed trying to justify why there can be no free people on Mississippi soil, but nobody else should have free black people on their soil either. And it's into this environment that we have the incredibly interesting but toxic election of 1860 that leads on Christmas Eve to South Carolina drafting ordinances of secession, in which they say very clearly that they are leaving because of the election of someone who will not protect property rights. And they make it very clear in no uncertain terms that they are leaving over slavery. And that takes me back to Justice Taney in the Dred Scott case, why I always think that is the point of no return. Because it is Taney in the Dred Scott case who moves far beyond the narrow question of whether or not a man who had been taken all over the United States by his master was slave or free. And in this opinion, Justice Taney, as an afterthought, says, okay, he's a slave. But he nationalizes slavery, making it clear that if anyone takes their slave to a free state or to free territory, then they are still a slave. There is no free status. And it obliterates any restrictions on slavery in the territories, and it obliterates any abilities of northern free states to deal with who and who cannot be within their borders or what their status would be. That is the very definition of nationalization, is the opposite of states' rights. And it is the moment when the threads of disunion become inevitable. Now, Lincoln is transformed by the war. He is not what the South Carolinians say he is in 1860. He's not an abolitionist. But he is changed, as men are, by war. And in the fall of 1862, he drafts something that I'm sure he could never have imagined 2 years earlier, an Emancipation Proclamation that on January 1st would liberate slaves who were in captured areas, thus beginning the process that culminates after his death. In December of 1865, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution will abolish slavery and involuntary servitude, and thus bring down nationally something that only the most radical of abolitionists ever dared to dream could happen in such a short period of time. So such are the peculiarities of history when people begin to take pen to paper and make strong statements in defense of a status quo that is actually indefensible in the sands of history.
Well, I'm the only one here who's not a historian. So I have enjoyed hearing what they've said about history. But my assignment was to talk about Lincoln and about his leadership and his rhetorical style, and particularly to address it to the Gettysburg Address, which I did when I made my speech. So now I want to talk about something else. You know, teachers have this flexibility to do what they want to. What I would like to share with you all is some ideas about Lincoln's influence on us. And think about yourselves. I thought about myself when I was trying to focus on this, and what influence did Lincoln have on me? Well, like many of you, I suppose, and when I was in junior high, I had to stand up and recite the Gettysburg Address. And I heard it 32 times in my classroom because there were 32 of us and everybody stood up and recited the Gettysburg Address. Now, I wouldn't say that I had a really good understanding of the rhetorical implications of it or even what it meant, but I knew it was important because I had to stand up and recite it. I don't know whether kids still do that or not. I hope they do, but I don't know. Probably not. No, they'd be watching television or watching the computer or something instead.
Yes.
Right, they'll be doing that instead. But I knew that the Gettysburg Address was an important document, and it was important to our history, and people who influenced my life knew that. The teachers did, and the society imposed that. So what I would think about today about that importance is that the content of that address, which I addressed before and I won't go over again, and the rhetorical style of that 10 sentences is all it was, my understanding of them have changed dramatically as I have aged and as I have lived through 72 years of watching what's happened in our country. And that's probably happened to you all too. And if you think about that and reflect on it, as I have a whole lot more in the last 2 months than I ever had before, you realize that what he said and the way he said it and the way he embodied it makes a huge difference and has really influenced us in a lot of ways. Think about the words, for example. There probably are not any more well-known phrases than of the people, by the people, and for the people. In American history, I'm talking about. I told you all the last time that I had read that people said it was no doubt the best known and best loved speech in America. And many people say it's the best loved and best known speech in the world. I don't have any data on that, so I'm not sure whether that's true or not, but it's a nice thing to be said about a speech you made anyway that was just 10 sentences long. But think about the influence that those words of the people, by the people, and for the people have had on us today. We hear them all the time. We know exactly what they mean. Now, they may mean different things to different people, and everybody has their own interpretation. But it's not something we've never heard before that we're not impressed with or is not a part of our lives. So I think as a part of Americans, this his phraseology is extremely important into who we think we are. It shapes us into the kind of person we are and the way we see the world and the way the rest of the world sees us. And if this is the best known and best loved speech in the world, then it also has that influence on other people because that's the way they see who we think we are. So Lincoln had a huge impact on our vision of ourselves. He also talked about all men are created equal. Now that of course goes back, it predates him, to the Declaration of Independence. But he emphasizes it again in this document, in his speech. And it is better known, probably because he emphasized it again, that it would have been just as a part of the Declaration of Independence. So as I think about this today and think about his influence on us and think about his influence on our country and the direction of our country and think about the influence that it has had, that we learned that we will not secede again. The country has not seceded. No part of it that I'm aware of, and I'm in the presence of historians, so I hate to say this, but as far as I can remember, no part of the country has tried to secede again, of our country has tried to secede. So one of the things we learned through his leadership at this period was that secession is not a viable option for a country that wants to grow and develop, that staying together is very important, and that the unity of the country is really important. So we think about his influence as a part of our country and as a leader of our country. But then I have read something recently that impressed me a great deal. And I want to read it to you all tonight. It's something that Lincoln said because it has a huge impact on us not only as Americans, but as humans. And it's on forgiveness. And I want to read this to you. Lincoln said, "I will greet this day with a forgiving spirit. For too long, every ounce of forgiveness I owned was locked away, hidden from view, waiting for me to bestow its precious presence on some worthy person. Alas, I found most people to be singularly unworthy of my valuable forgiveness. And since they never asked for any of it, I kept it all to myself. Now the forgiveness that I hoarded has sprouted inside my heart like a crippled seed yielding bitter fruit. No more. At this moment, my life has taken on new hope and assurance. Of all the world's population, I am one of the few possessors of the secret to dissipating anger and resentment. I now understand that forgiveness has value only when it's given away. By the simple act of granting forgiveness, I release the demons of the past about which I can do nothing, and I create in myself a new heart, a new beginning. I will greet this day with a forgiving spirit. I will forgive even those who do not ask for forgiveness. Many are the times when I have seethed in anger at a word or deed thrown out into my life by an unthinking or uncaring person. I have wasted valuable hours imagining revenge or confusion. Now I see the truth revealed about this psychological rock inside my shoe. The rage I nurture is often one-sided, for my offender seldom gives thought to his offense. I will now and forevermore silently offer my forgiveness, even to those who do not see that they need it. By the act of forgiving, I am no longer consumed by unproductive thoughts. I give up my bitterness. I'm content with my soul and effective again with my fellow man. I will greet this day with a forgiving spirit. I will forgive those who criticize me unjustly, knowing that slavery in any form is wrong. I also know that the person who lives a life according to the opinion of others is a slave. I am not a slave. I have chosen my counsel. I know the difference between right and wrong. I know what is best for the future of my family, and neither misguided opinion nor unjust criticism will alter my course. Those who are critical of my goals and dreams simply do not understand the higher purpose to which I have been called. Therefore, their scorn does not affect my attitude or my action. I forgive their lack of vision, and I forge ahead. I now know that criticism is part of the price paid for leaping past mediocrity. I will greet this day with a forgiving spirit. I will forgive myself. For many years, my greatest enemy has been myself. Every mistake, every miscalculation, every stumble I have made has been replayed again and again in my mind. Every broken promise, every day wasted, every goal not reached has compounded the disgust I feel for the lack of achievement in my life. My dismay has developed a paralyzing grip. When I disappoint myself, I respond with inaction and become more disappointed. I realize today that it's impossible to fight an enemy living in my head. By forgiving myself, I erase the doubts, fears, and frustration that have kept my pace in the past. From this day forward, my history will cease to control my destiny. I have forgiven myself. My life has just begun. I will forgive even those who do not ask for forgiveness. I will forgive those who criticize me unjustly. I will forgive myself. I will greet this day with a forgiving spirit. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful phraseology and rhetoric from the man who wrote the Gettysburg Address and other things? When I ran across this, I thought, you know, the Gettysburg Address has huge meaning to us as a country and as individuals in a society, in a social structure. But this has huge meaning to us as people, as humans, as individuals. So the man had a tremendous impact on us, if we read what he says.
When did he write this?
I don't know when this happened. I'm sorry to say that I don't know what the occasion. When he talked about his family, you wonder what the occasion for that was.
I guess it could be the death of one of the children.
It sounds like it might be.
Well, that was exactly what I thought it sounds like, you know. And he certainly struggled with melancholia,
it
was called.
Absolutely.
But that's exactly what that suggests to me, someone who's struggling with the fog
exactly.
that is enveloping him.
Well, I just have one or two thoughts.
We'll forgive you.
Wait for the test out.
I think it's clear to anybody who looks at the career of Abraham Lincoln that he was a person who grew and matured very quickly once he was put into what was basically an untenable position. He may not have been able to handle the secession crisis. Frankly, I'm not sure that anybody else could have done any better, including those who came after him. But he learned, he grew, he matured, and he became a great leader and a great communicator. I think the seeds of the disunion and Patty do go back to the very founding of the United States, the misnamed United States between 1776 and 1787. Because during that time, there was not one country. Rather, there were 14 independent countries, the 13 colonies that signed the Declaration of Independence, plus the independent Republic of Vermont. There was no central executive power. There was no ability to raise money. There was no ability to do anything with troops. The Articles of Confederation were a flawed document from the beginning. It's surprising that they lasted as long as they did. And if you want to think about what it was like, think about the European Union today. The European Union today is far more of a united, quote-unquote, country than the 13 colonies were during the Articles of Confederation. when they came together and ratified the Constitution, they really still had this idea that they were independent of one another to a significant degree. And I think that that's really something that even today, the U.S. as a federal republic seems to have more devolvement to the states than most other federal republics in the world. So I think the seeds began, unfortunately, with that beginning of our country. Really, it was not until the ratification of the 14th Amendment that the Bill of Rights even applied to the states. And there's actually some question now as to which parts and how they apply and for what reasons, things that we are still grappling with today. However, I think that we had a terrible conflict, but I think the country emerged stronger. Do any of you have anything to say to respond to the other panelists or questions for the other panelists?
This is not a response to others, but recently, as I was trying to prepare for this, and I read all the books I could find on the causes and why did the South lose, why did the North win, etc. I found a book by everybody else probably knew about it, by a former history professor from the University of Kentucky, who is a Southern writer, and his name is Charles Rowland. And the title of his book is History Well, now I've forgotten.
Welcome.
History teaches us to hope. History teaches us to hope. Do you think, in studying the Civil War, that we have arrived at that?
At hope?
No, teaching us to hope. As some of you know, my background, I've come a long way just saying the Civil War. growing up in a family where it was the war between the states. So I think, you know, we all have a lot to learn about our history. And I would encourage you to begin, if you haven't already. I mean, here we are in the sesquicentennial. We can look at the Civil War. We don't have to stop there. We can keep on hoping. Thank you.
One thing I can just add to that, there's an increasingly interesting literature on history and memory and why it is, as one of my mentors in graduate school used to say, that we insist on continuing to define region by 4 years in the middle of the 19th century, which, you know, as someone who was an expert in Southern history and the tendency to obsess over this in ways that really wouldn't be acceptable. If you're German, it's not okay to obsess nonstop about why it didn't work out for you in 4 years in the middle of, or 6 years in the middle of the 20th century. But it's a topic of absolutely nonstop interest. But I think the people who work on history and memory and why we think this is important and how what we think about changes over time, I think they have a lot to tell us, and long may they continue to do so.
And what do Canadians say about this, Jen?
About the Civil War in general? Well, when the Civil War was raging on the southern border of Canada, Canada was not actually a nation as of yet. It was still very much a British entity, and it's the Fenian raids in the post-Civil War era, as Canadians like to joke, seven drunk Irishmen decide they're going to come from New York and invade Toronto. And it actually prompts Canadian Confederation in 1867. Canada decides that with such a large entity harboring just below us, that we need to be a little more codified and a little more unified in case something happens again and it all kind of explodes. And one of the things that's interesting when you look at the long history of slavery is the connection that Canada and the United States do have in relation to slavery. I grew up 45 minutes away from the end of the Underground Railroad. And of course, Canada gets slavery is whitewashed in Canada very much, but it was actually fairly active, but we don't have a lot of cotton plantations in southwestern
or sugar cane.
or anything warm. So, you know, it became kind of a haven, and I think it took on an unfair reputation as being kind of this mecca. Now, for other things, Canada definitely is a mecca. It's become even better. But, you know, I think that's part two of the legacy of Canada having this reputation of harboring American war fugitives. If you look at the Civil War, we took in the slaves. If you look at the Vietnam War, we took in all the draft dodgers. So I don't know if that answers your question.
The harbor of dissent.
Yes. But the one thing to add to what Dr. Minter was saying is the whole memory study, I mean, they've gone even into the realm of popular culture. This is not just a high history academic study. If you look at Tony Horowitz's endlessly fascinating book, Confederates in the Attic, you really see the depths that some people have clung to these ideas of the Civil War and what its significance and meaning are.
What other periods of history or of Civil War, I guess, around the world maintain this that the Confederacy does, is this great affinity for?
Maybe the Scots.
Yes.
Probably.
Yeah. Bonnie Prince Charlie is.
Yeah. It's one of the few. It's one of the few examples where the losing cause clings to this identity as it was the noble as the noble cause.
So it's fairly unusual.
It is fairly unusual, and in my civil rights movement class, of course, we spent a semester talking about how a lot of that is because the transformation of slaves from property to free people creates exactly what the South feared, which was a large group of free people in their mass that would threaten white supremacy, and that's a continuity that goes all the way through. So I mean, there's change, but there really is a remarkable continuity, and we've spent 15 weeks exploring that this semester. So
I think the other example is the First World War in places like Britain and Canada and the British Empire type places. Australia, Canada still does a First World War Remembrance Ceremony every November 18th. And it's not World War II they're commemorating, it's the First World War with the poppies. And so they still have that kind of, this was a great war where even though we won, we're going to never forget why and the significance.
But of course, they were on the winning side.
It's the only war that Canada did really well in. We're not military people.
There are lots of monuments to Gallipoli in Australia as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's huge. In public squares, if you see something that's obviously militaristic, it's a very good chance that's the Gallipoli monument.
In Turkey, there's not that kind of nostalgia for the Ottoman Empire. In fact, from what I understand from one of my former student workers who is from Turkey, the monuments to Gallipoli at Gallipoli are actually anti-war for the most part. So it is very interesting how this has remained a real focus of our American psyche 150 years later. Are there any questions from the audience or the panelists? Yes.
I have been studying Lincoln for a long time. But I have never heard that thing that you read.
Mm-hmm.
Where could I get a copy of it?
I'll be happy to send you where I got it from a colleague who was talking about apologia in communication, about apology, and he said as a part of apology, it's not necessary with forgiveness, and that's where he came for this. Yeah. But I'll be happy to get you a copy of it. It's beautiful, isn't it? I had never seen it before either.
I never had seen it before either.
Beautiful.
I need to.
Sir.
I heard more online, but there weren't any dates with them. I don't know, but there's, it's fully quoted online. I searched for that first line, but none had a date. I was interested.
Is that right? Well, I was interested when you asked, you know, what the occasion was. I don't have any idea on what it was, but you can sit and think about all the things that might have been during his life, what might have occasioned this. But I'll be happy to get you a copy of it.
Well, it's very interesting because I went back to school when I was 50 years old, and Nancy Baird gave me a birthday party right before the final exam. Well, I forgot what I was going to say.
Well, that was after he had written this.
You know, I've just been so interested in trying to find out why my daddy would tell me that when he was 5 years old, his granddaddy used to send him across the road in Goodlettsville, Tennessee, to get his pension check. Well, when I got old enough to start thinking, they didn't have Social Security in 1910, and it wasn't railroad retirement. And I started trying to find out what the pension check was. And it was a pension from the Civil War.
Interesting.
And I thought the Confederacy didn't get pension checks.
Yeah, they did after Tennessee.
He joined the Army, the Union Army in Illinois, and was on the Union side. So now I'm trying to find out if he was a carpetbagger. But I'm just, my ancestry has taken over my life lately, and I really
Well, I'll be glad to get you a copy of this. I need to do some more research, I guess, myself and find out when he said it. And something that I read when I was preparing for this that I thought was so interesting about Gettysburg and about the speech is that this is the first time, it was a large crowd there to hear this, and this was the first time that they had seen the president. And I thought, first time they'd seen their president. How strange that is for us to imagine that this is, you know, you just wish sometimes you wouldn't see all the candidates. I think the first time they'd seen him, and they were so shocked at how tall he was. Uh-huh. And I was thinking, isn't that bizarre that these young people up here can't possibly imagine what it was like, that you didn't see people constantly more than you want to see them sometimes.
Yeah, there could be a candid debate going on right now. Wasn't there one yesterday?
Yeah. So it's very interesting the way the world has changed and our society and our views of people and issues have changed. And yet some things are still very profound and stay with us.
By the way, the federal government did give pensions to Confederate soldiers, but not until sometime like 1911, and by that time 90% of them were gone. But it's
sounds like a government
much,
thing.
Much later.
I'm involved in the genealogy society that meets in this room on the third Monday of the month, and I found that out that the Confederacy, the states gave
Is it
pensions.
The
It wasn't the Confederacy like
no,
the Union
well, there
was.
Bob Carrico, my husband's grandfather, no, I guess great-grandfather, got his down until 1929. Ooh. I mean, he lived that long.
Wow.
Gosh.
So. And
how long my grandfather
did. Any other questions?
I just thought of something else kind of cute that I read in one of those many things, and they were discussing Gettysburg, and that poor old George Pickett was always put on the firing line, like, what happened? Why did you lose? What do you account for really what happened at Gettysburg? And he said, I think the Union Army had a great deal to do with it.
Yeah. The reporters were the same as they are now.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you to all of you on the panel. This has been a wonderful series, and let's show our appreciation.